tricky to bring up in any meaningful way with their male friends. It's no wonder that the rates of substance abuse and suicide in middle-aged men continue to increase. Many men don't feel they have any other place to turn. So I let John take his time to sort out his feelings about Margot's threat and the softer message that might be behind it. I haven't seen him sit with his feelings this long before, and I'm impressed that he's able to do so now. John's eyes have darted down and to the side, which is what usually happens with someone when what I'm saying touches someplace vulnerable, and I'm glad. It's impossible to grow without first becoming vulnerable. It looks like he's still really taking this in, that for the first time, his impact on Margot is resonating. Finally, John looks back up at me.
Hi, sorry. I had to mute you back there. They were taping. I missed that. What were you saying?
Unfucking believable! I've been quite literally talking to myself. No wonder Margot wants to leave. I should have listened to my gut and had John reschedule an in-person session, but I got sucked in by his urgent plea. John, I say, I really want to help you with this, but I think this is too important to talk about on Skype. Let's schedule a time for you to come in so there aren't so many
Oh, no. No, 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 he interrupts. This can't wait. I just had to give you the background first so you can talk to him.
To
the idiot therapist. Clearly, he's only hearing one side of the story, and not a very accurate side at that. But you know me. You can vouch for me. You can give this guy some perspective before Margot really goes nuts.
I noodle this scenario around in my head. John wants me to call my own therapist to discuss why my patient isn't happy with the therapy my therapist is doing with my patient's wife. No. Even if Wendell weren't my therapist, I wouldn't make this call. Sometimes I'll call another therapist to discuss a patient if, say, I'm seeing a couple and a colleague is seeing one member of the couple and there's a compelling reason to exchange information. Somebody is suicidal or potentially violent, or we're working on something in one setting that would be helpful to have reinforced in another, or we want to get a broader perspective. But on these rare occasions, the parties will have signed releases to this effect. Wendell or no Wendell, I can't call up the therapist of my patient's wife for no clinically relevant reason and without both patients signing consent forms.
Let me ask you something, I say to John. What?
Do you miss Margot?
Do I miss her?
Yes.
You're not going to call Margot's therapist, are you?
I'm not. And you're not going to tell me how you really feel about Margot, are you? I have a feeling that there's a lot of buried love between John and Margot. Because I know this. Love can often look like so many things that don't seem like love. John smiles as I see somebody who I assume is Tommy again enter the frame holding a script. I'm flipped toward the ground with such speed that I get dizzy, as if I'm on a roller coaster that just took a quick dive. Staring at John's shoes, I hear some back and forth about whether the character, my favorite, is supposed to be a complete asshole in this scene or maybe have some awareness that he's being an asshole. Interestingly, John picks awareness. And then Tommy thanks John and leaves. To my amusement, John seems perfectly pleasant, apologizing to Tommy for his absence and explaining to him that he's busy putting out a fire with the network. I'm the network. Maybe he's polite to his coworkers after all. Or maybe not. He waits for Tommy to leave, then lifts me up to face level again and mouths, "Idiot," rolling his eyes in Tommy's direction. I just don't understand how her therapist, who's a guy, can't see both sides of this, he continues. Even you can see both sides of this.
Even me? I smile.
Was that a compliment you just gave me?
No offense, I just meant, you know.
I do know, but I want him to say it. In his own way, he's becoming attached to me, and I want him to stay in his emotional world a bit longer. But John goes back to his tirade about Margot pulling the wool over her therapist's eyes and how Wendell is a quack because his sessions are only 45 minutes, not the typical 50. This bugs me too, by the way. It occurs to me that John is talking about Wendell the way a husband might talk about a man his wife has a crush on. I think he's jealous and feels left out of whatever goes on between Margot and Wendell in that room. I'm jealous too. Does Wendell laugh at Margot's jokes? Does he like her better? I want to bring John back to that moment when he almost connected with me. I'm glad that you feel understood by me, I say. John gets a deer-in-the-headlights look on his face for a second, then moves on. All I want to know is how to deal with Margot. She already told you, I say. She misses you. I can see from our experience together how skilled you are at pushing away people who care about you. I'm not leaving, but Margot's saying she might. So maybe you'll try something different with her. Maybe you'll let her know that you miss her, too. I pause. Because I might be wrong, but I think you do miss her. He shrugs. And this time when he looks down, I'm not on mute. I miss the way we were, he says. His expression is sad instead of angry now. Anger is the go-to feeling for most people because it's outward directed. Angrily blaming others can feel deliciously sanctimonious. But often it's only the tip of the iceberg. And if you look beneath the surface, you'll glimpse submerged feelings you either weren't aware of or didn't want to show. Fear, helplessness, envy, loneliness, insecurity. And if you can tolerate these deeper feelings long enough to understand them and listen to what they're telling you, you'll not only manage your anger in more productive ways, you also won't be so angry all the time. Of course, anger serves another function. It pushes people away and keeps them from getting close enough to see you. I wonder if John needs people to be angry at him so that they won't see his sadness. I start to speak, but somebody yells John's name, startling him. The phone slips out of his hand and careens toward the floor. But just as I feel like my face might hit the ground, John catches it, bringing himself back into view. Crap, gotta go, he says. Then, under his breath, fucking morons. And the screen goes blank. Apparently, our session is over. With time to spare before my next session, I head into the kitchen for a snack. Two of my colleagues are there. Hillary is making tea, Mike's eating a sandwich. Hypothetically, I say, what would you do if your patient's wife was seeing your therapist and your patient thought your therapist was an idiot? They look up at me, eyebrows raised. Hypotheticals in this kitchen are never hypothetical. I'd switch therapists, Hillary says. I'd keep my therapist and switch patients, Mike says. They both laugh. No, really, I say. What would you do? It gets worse. He wants me to talk to my therapist about his wife. His wife doesn't know he's in therapy yet, so it's a non-issue now. But what if at some point he tells her and then wants me to consult with my therapist about his wife, and his wife consents? Do I have to disclose that he's my therapist? Absolutely, Hillary says. Not necessarily, Mike says at the same time. Exactly, I say. It's not clear. And you know why it's not clear? Because this kind of thing never happens. When has something like this ever happened? Hillary pours me some tea. I once had two people come to me individually for therapy right after they'd separated, Mike says. They had different last names and listed different addresses because of the separation. So I didn't know they were married until the second session with each of them, when I realized I was hearing the same stories from different sides. Their mutual friend, who was a former patient, gave both of them my name. I had to refer them out. Yeah, I say, but this isn't two patients with a conflict of interest. My therapist is mixed up in this. What are the odds of that? I notice Hillary looking away. What? I say. Nothing. Mike looks at her. She blushes. Spill it, he says. Hillary sighs. Okay. About 20 years ago, when I was first starting out, I was seeing a young guy for depression. I felt like we were making progress, but then the therapy seemed to stall. I thought he wasn't ready to move forward. But really, I just didn't have enough experience and was too green to know the difference. Anyway, he left. And about a year later, I ran into him at my therapist's. Mike grins. Your patient left you for your own therapist? Hillary nods. The funny thing is, in therapy, I talked about how stuck I was with this patient and how helpless I felt when he left. I'm sure the patient later told my therapist about his inept former therapist and used my name at some point. My therapist had to have put two and two together. I think about this in relation to the Wendell situation. But your therapist never said anything? Never, Hillary says. So one day I brought it up. But of course, she can't say that she sees this guy. So we kept the conversation focused on how I deal with the insecurities of being a new therapist. Poof! My feelings? Whatever. I was just dying to know how their therapy was going, and what she did differently with him that worked better. You'll never know, I say. Hillary shakes her head. I'll never know. We're like vaults, Mike says. You can't break us. Hillary turns to me. So, are you going to tell your therapist? Should I? They both shrug. Mike glances at the clock, tosses his trash into the can. Hillary and I take our last sips of tea. It's time for our next sessions. One by one, the green lights on the kitchen's master panel go on, and we file out to retrieve our patients from the waiting room. Chapter 22. Jail. Wendell says, after I make my book confession well into our session. It's taken me a while to get up the courage to tell him. For 2 weeks, I've moved over to position B, planning to confess all. But once we're face to face, catty corner on the couches, I stall. I talk about my son's teacher, pregnant, my dad's health, poor, a dream, freaky, chocolate, a tangent, I'll admit, my emerging forehead wrinkles, not a tangent, surprisingly, and the meaning of life, mine. Wendell tries to focus me, but I'm skating so quickly from one thing to the next that I outmaneuver him. Or so I think. Out of the blue, Wendell yawns. It's a fake yawn, a strategic one, a big, dramatic, gaping yawn. It's a yawn that says, until you tell me what's really on your mind, you'll stay stuck exactly where you are. Then he sits back and studies me. I have something to tell you, I say. He looks at me like, no shit. And out comes the entire story in one fell swoop. He says again. So you don't want to write this book? I nod. And if you don't turn in the book, there will be serious financial and professional repercussions? Right. I shrug as if to say, see how screwed I am? If I'd just done the parenting book, I say, I wouldn't be in this situation. It's the refrain I've been repeating to myself daily, sometimes hourly, for the past few years. Wendell does his shrug, smile, wait routine. I know, I sigh. I made a colossal, irrevocable mistake. I feel the panic well up again. That's not what I'm thinking, he says. Then what? He starts singing. Half my life is over, oh yeah, half my life has passed me by. I roll my eyes, but he keeps going. It's a bluesy tune, and I'm trying to place it. Etta James? B.B. King? I wish I could go back, change the past, have more years to get it right. And then I realize it's not a famous song. It's Wendell Bronson, impromptu lyricist. His lyrics are awful, but he surprises me with his strong, resonant voice. The song goes on, and he's really getting into it, tapping his feet, snapping his fingers. If we were out in the world, I'd think he was a nerdy guy in a cardigan. But in here, it's his confidence and spontaneity that strikes me, his willingness to be fully himself, entirely unconcerned that he'll come across as foolish or unprofessional. I can't imagine doing this in front of my patients. 'Cause half my life is over. He arrives at the finale, complete with jazz hands. Wendell stops singing and looks at me seriously. I want to tell him that he's being annoying, that he's trivializing what is realistically and practically an anxiety-provoking problem. But before I can say that, I feel a heavy sadness descend, seemingly out of nowhere. His tune is going through my head. It's like that Mary Oliver poem, I say to Wendell. What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
I thought I knew what I planned to do. But now everything has changed. I was going to be with boyfriend. I was going to write what mattered to me. I never expected to be in this situation. Wendell gives me a look. Here we go again. We're like an old married couple by now, finishing each other's sentences. But then Wendell is silent, and it doesn't seem like the intentional kind of silence I'm used to. It occurs to me that maybe Wendell is stumped, the way I sometimes get stumped in sessions when my patients are stuck and I get stuck too. He's tried yawning and singing and redirecting me and asking important questions. But still, I'm back to where I usually go, the saga of my losses. I was just thinking about what you want in here, he says. How do you think I can help you? I'm thrown by his question. I don't know if he's enlisting my help as a fellow therapist or asking me as his patient. Either way, I'm not sure. What do I want from therapy? I don't know, I say. But as soon as I say it, I'm scared. Maybe Wendell can't help me. Maybe nothing can. Maybe I just have to learn to live with my choices. I think I can help, he says. But maybe not in the way you imagine. I can't bring your boyfriend back, and I can't give you a redo. And now you're in this book situation, and you want me to save you from that, too. And I can't do that either. I let out a snort at how preposterous this is. I don't want you to save me, I say. I'm a head of household, not a damsel in distress. He locks his eyes on mine. I look away. Nobody is going to save you, he says quietly. But I don't want to be saved, I insist. Though this time, part of me wonders, wait, do I? On some level, don't we all? I think about how people come to therapy expecting to feel better. But what does better really mean? There's a magnet that somebody stuck on the refrigerator in our office's kitchen. Peace. It does not mean to be in a place where there is no noise, trouble, or hard work. It means to be in the midst of those things and still be calm in your heart. We can help patients find peace, but maybe a different kind than they'd imagine they'd find when they started treatment. As the late psychotherapist John Weakland famously said, before successful therapy, it's the same damn thing over and over. After successful therapy, it's one damn thing after another. I know that therapy won't make all my problems disappear, prevent new ones from developing, or ensure that I'll always act from a place of enlightenment. Therapists don't perform personality transplants. They just help to take the sharp edges off. A patient may become less reactive or critical, more open and able to let people in. In other words, therapy is about understanding the self that you are. But part of getting to know yourself is to unknow yourself, to let go of the limiting stories you've told yourself about who you are so that you aren't trapped by them, so you can live your life and not the story you've been telling yourself about your life. But how to help people do this is another matter. I go through the problem again in my mind. Must write book to have roof overhead. Turn down opportunity to write book that would have put roof overhead for years to come. Can't seem to write stupid book about stupid topic that's making me miserable. Will force myself to write stupid, miserable happiness book. Have tried to force myself to write stupid, miserable happiness book, but end up on Facebook, feeling envious of all the people who manage to have their shit together. I remember a quote from Einstein. No problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. I've always felt that made sense. But like most of us, I also believe that I should be able to think my way out of my problem by going over and over how I thought myself into it. I just see no way out of this, I say. And I don't just mean the book. I mean the whole this, everything that's happened. Wendell leans back, uncrosses and recrosses his legs, then closes his eyes, something he does when he seems to be gathering his thoughts. When he opens his eyes again, we sit there for a while, saying nothing. Two therapists comfortable together in a long silence. I lean back and luxuriate in it, and I think about how I wish everyone could do this more in daily life. Simply be together with no phones, laptops, TVs, or idle chit-chat. Just
presence. Sitting like this makes me feel relaxed and energized at the same time. Finally, Wendell speaks up. "I'm reminded," he begins, "of a famous cartoon. It's of a prisoner, shaking the bars, desperately trying to get out. But to his right and left, it's open. No bars." He pauses, allowing the image to sink in. All the prisoner has to do is walk around. But still, he frantically shakes the bars. That's most of us. We feel completely stuck, trapped in our emotional cells. But there's a way out, as long as we're willing to see it. He lets that last part linger between us. As long as we're willing to see it. He gestures to an imaginary prison cell with his hand, inviting me to see it. I look away, but I feel Wendell's eyes on me. I sigh. Okay. I close my eyes and take a breath. I start by picturing the prison, a tiny cell with drab beige walls. I picture the metal bars, thick and gray and rusty. I picture myself in an orange jumpsuit, furiously shaking those bars, pleading for release. I picture my life in this tiny cell with nothing but the pungent smell of urine and the prospect of a dismal, constrained future. I imagine screaming, "Get me out of here! Save me!" I envision myself frantically looking to my right, then to my left, then doing one hell of a double take. I notice my whole body respond. I feel lighter, like a 1,000-pound weight has been lifted, as the realization hits me. You are your own jailer. I open my eyes and glance at Wendell. He raises his right eyebrow as if to say, "I know. You see. I saw you see. Keep looking," he whispers. I close my eyes again. Now I'm walking around the bars and heading toward the exit, moving tentatively at first. But as I get closer to it, I start to run. Outside, I can feel my feet on the ground, the breeze on my skin, the sun's warmth on my face. I'm free. I run as fast as I can. Then after a while, I slow down and check behind me. No prison guards are giving chase. It occurs to me that there were no prison guards to begin with. Of course. Most of us come to therapy feeling trapped, imprisoned by our thoughts, behaviors, marriages, jobs, fears, or past. Sometimes we imprison ourselves with a narrative of self-punishment. If we have a choice between believing one of two things, both of which we have evidence for, I'm unlovable, I'm lovable, often we choose the one that makes us feel bad. Why do we keep our radios tuned to the same static-ridden stations? The everyone's life is better than mine station, the I can't trust people station, the nothing works out for me station. Instead of moving the dial up or down, change the station, walk around the bars. Who's stopping us but ourselves? There is a way out, as long as we're willing to see it. A cartoon, of all things, has taught me the secret of life. I open my eyes and smile, and Wendell smiles back. It's a conspiratorial smile, one that says, "Don't be fooled. It may seem as though you've had an earth-shattering breakthrough, but this is just the beginning." I know full well what challenges lie ahead, and Wendell knows that I know, because we both know something else. Freedom involves responsibility. And there's a part of most of us that finds responsibility frightening. Might it feel safer to stay in jail? I picture the bars and the open sides again. A part of me lobbies to stay, another to go. I choose to go. But walking around the bars in my mind is different from walking around them in real life. Insight is the booby prize of therapy, is my favorite maxim of the trade. Meaning that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't change when you're out in the world, the insight, and the therapy, is worthless. Insight allows you to ask yourself, is this something that's being done to me, or am I doing it to myself? The answer gives you choices, but it's up to you to make them. Are you ready to start talking about the fight you're in? Wendell asks. You mean the fight with boyfriend? I begin. Or with myself? No, your fight with death, Wendell says.
For a second, I'm confused. But then I flash to my dream about running into boyfriend at the mall. Him. Did you ever write your book? Me. What book? Him. The book about your death. Oh. My. God. Typically, therapists are several steps ahead of our patients. Not because we're smarter or wiser, but because we have the vantage point of being outside their lives. I'll say to a patient who has bought the ring but can't seem to find the right time to propose to his girlfriend, I don't think you're sure you want to marry her. And he'll say, what? Of course I am. I'm doing it this weekend. And then he goes home and doesn't propose because the weather was bad and he wanted to do it at the beach. We'll have the same dialogue for weeks until one day he'll come back and say, maybe I don't want to marry her. Many people who say, no, that's not me, find themselves a week or a month or a year later saying, yeah, actually, that's me. I have a feeling that Wendell has been storing up this question, waiting for just the right moment to float it out there. Therapists are always weighing the balance between forming a trusting alliance and getting to the real work so the patient doesn't have to continue suffering. From the outset, we move both slowly and quickly, slowing the content down, speeding up the relationship, planting seeds strategically along the way. As in nature, if you plant the seeds too early, they won't sprout. If you plant too late, they might make progress, but you've missed the most fertile ground. If you plant at just the right time, though, they'll soak up the nutrients and grow. Our work is an intricate dance between support and confrontation. Wendell asks about my fight with death at exactly the right moment, but for more reasons than he could possibly know. Chapter 23. Trader Joe's. It's a busy Saturday morning at Trader Joe's, and I'm scanning the lines to see which is shortest, while my son darts off to look at the display of chocolate bars. Despite the chaos, the cashiers seem unfazed. A young guy whose arms are covered in tattoos rings a bell, and a bagger in leggings dances over and packs up a customer's groceries, jiving to the canned music. In the next aisle, a hipster with a mohawk calls for a price check, and at the end of the row, a pretty blonde cashier juggles some oranges to amuse a toddler having a meltdown in her stroller. It takes me a minute before I realize that the juggling cashier is my patient, Julie. I haven't seen her new blonde wig yet, though she mentioned it in therapy. Too crazy? She'd asked about the idea of being a blonde, holding me to my promise to tell her if she was going overboard. She'd asked the same thing about answering an ad for a singer in a local band, going on a game show, and signing up for a Buddhist retreat that required a full week of no talking. This was all before the miracle drug had worked its miracle on her tumors. I'd enjoyed watching her stretch from the risk-averse stance she'd embraced all her life. She had always thought that achieving tenure would give her freedom. But now she was tasting a completely unexpected kind of freedom. Is this too off the wall? She'd sometimes say, before presenting a new idea to me. She was eager to veer from her mapped-out course, but not so far that she'd get lost. Yet nothing she proposed surprised me. Then, finally, Julie had an idea that caught me off guard. She told me that at one point during those weeks, when she believed she was about to die, she was waiting in line at Trader Joe's and found herself mesmerized by the cashiers. They seemed so themselves in the ways they interacted with their customers and with one another, making conversation about the small daily things that are really the big things in people's lives. Food, traffic, the weather. How different she imagined this job from her own, which she loved, but which also came with a constant pressure to produce and publish, to position herself for advancement. With a shortened future, she imagined doing work where she could see tangible results in the moment. You pack groceries, you cheer up customers, you stock items. At the end of the day, you've done something concrete and useful. Julie decided that if she had only, say, a year to live, she'd apply to be a weekend cashier at Trader Joe's. She knew she was idealizing the job, but she still wanted to experience that sense of purpose and community, of being a small part of lots of different people's lives, even if just for the time it took to ring up their groceries. Maybe Trader Joe's can be part of my Holland, she mused. I could feel myself push against the idea, and I sat for a minute, trying to understand why. It might have had something to do with a dilemma I'd been facing in treating Julie. If Julie hadn't had cancer, I'd try to help her look at the part of her that had felt inhibited for so long. She seemed to be opening the lid on aspects of herself that hadn't had space to breathe. But with someone who's dying, did it make sense to do therapy or simply offer support? Should I treat Julie like a healthy patient in terms of more ambitious goals? Or should I just offer comfort and not upset the apple cart? I wondered if Julie would ever have asked herself the questions about risk and safety and identity that had been hiding beneath her awareness had she not faced the terror of imminent death. And now that she had, how far should we delve into them? These are questions we all deal with in a quieter way. How much do we want to know? How much is too much? And how much is too much when you're dying? The Trader Joe's fantasy seemed to represent an escape of some sort. Like a child saying, I'm running away to Disneyland. And I wondered how this fantasy related to Julie's pre-cancer self. But mostly, I wondered if she could handle the job physically. The experimental treatment had added to her fatigue. She needed rest. Her husband, she told me, thought she was insane. You have a limited time to live, and your dream is to work at Trader Joe's? He'd asked. Why? What would you do if you only had a year or so to live? Julie countered. I'd work less, he said, not more. As Julie told me about Matt's reaction, it occurred to me that he and I both seemed unsupportive, even though we wanted Julie to experience joy. Sure, there were some practical concerns. But could our hesitation also be that we were both, in a strange way, envious of Julie and her conviction to follow her dream, no matter how odd it sounded? Therapists tell their patients, follow your envy. It shows you what you want. Did watching Julie's blossoming highlight the fact that we were too afraid to act on our own equivalence of working at Trader Joe's? And that we wanted Julie to remain like us, dreaming without doing, constrained by nothing more than the open bars on our prison cells? Or maybe that was just me. Besides, Matt had said in his conversation with Julie, don't you want to spend that time together? Julie said that of course she did, but she also wanted to work at Trader Joe's, and it became a kind of obsession. So she applied for a job there, and on the day that she learned she was tumor-free, she was offered a Saturday morning shift. In my office, Julie got out her cell phone and played both phone messages for me. One from her oncologist, one from a manager at Trader Joe's. She was grinning as if she'd won not just any lottery, but the Powerball of all Powerballs. I told them yes, she said, after the Trader Joe's message ended. She explained that nobody knew if the tumors would come back, and she didn't want to just add things to her bucket list. She wanted to cross things off, too. You have to pare it down, she said, or else it's just a useless exercise in what could have been. So here I am, standing in the market, and I'm not sure which checkout line to choose. I knew, of course, that Julie had started working at Trader Joe's, but I had no idea it was this Trader Joe's. She hasn't seen me yet, and I can't help but watch her from afar. She rings the bell for a bagger, gets a child some stickers, laughs with a customer over something I can't hear. She's like the queen of cashiers, the party everyone wants to be at. People seem to know her, and not surprisingly, she's incredibly efficient, moving the line along quickly. I feel my eyes get wet, and the next thing I know, my son calls out, Mom, over here! And I see that he has negotiated his way into Julie's line. I hesitate. After all, Julie might feel awkward ringing up her therapist. And, truth be told, I might feel awkward too. She knows so little about me that even displaying the contents of my shopping cart feels somehow too revealing. But mostly, I'm thinking about how Julie talks about the sadness she experiences whenever she sees her friends' kids while she and her husband are trying to find a way to become parents themselves. What will it be like for her to see me with my son? Over here, I reply, gesturing for Zach to move to a different line. But this one's shorter, he yells back. And of course it is, because Julie's so goddamn deficient. And that's when Julie looks over at my son and then follows his gaze to me. Busted. I smile. She smiles. I start to head to the other line, but Julie says, "Hey, lady, listen to the boy. This line's shorter." I join Zach in Julie's line. I try not to stare as we wait our turn, but I can't help it. I'm watching the real-life version of the vision she described in her therapy session. Her dream literally come true. When Zach and I get to the register, Julie banters with us as she does with her other customers. "Joe's O's," she says to my son. "A good breakfast." "They're for my mom," he answers. "No offense, but I like Cheerios better." Julie looks around to make sure nobody's in earshot, gives him a sly wink, and whispers, "Don't tell anyone, but me too." They spend the rest of the time discussing the merits of the various chocolate bars my son selected. When we're all bagged up and rolling our cart away, Zach examines the stickers from Julie. "I like that lady," he says. "I do too," I say. It isn't until half an hour later, as I'm unpacking the bags in my kitchen, that I see something scrawled on my credit card receipt. "I'm pregnant," it says. Chapter 24. Hello, family. Chart note, Rita. Patient is a divorced woman who presents with depression, expresses regret over what she believes to be bad choices and a life poorly lived. Reports that if her life doesn't improve in 1 year, she plans to end it. "I have something to show you," Rita says. In the hallway between the waiting room and my office, she hands me her cell phone. Rita has never handed me her phone before, much less begun speaking to me before we're settled in my office with the door closed, so I'm surprised by the gesture. She indicates that I should take a look. On her screen is a profile from the dating app called Bumble. Rita recently started using Bumble because, unlike more hookup-oriented apps like Tinder, "revolting," she said, "Bumble allows only women to contact men." Coincidentally, my friend Jen had just sent an article about it and forwarded it to me with the message, "For whenever you're ready to date again." I'd texted back, "Whenever isn't here yet." I glance from the phone to Rita. "Well," she says expectantly as we enter my office. "Well, what?" I ask, handing her back the phone. I'm not sure what she's getting at. "Well, what?" she replies incredulously. "He's 82. I'm no spring chicken, but please. I know what 80 looks like naked, and that gave me nightmares for a week. I'm sorry, but 75 is as far as I'll go, and don't try to talk me out of it." Rita, I should mention, is 69. A few weeks ago, after months of encouragement, Rita had decided to try a dating app. After all, in her daily life, she wasn't encountering any single older men, much less those who met her requirements. Intelligent, kind, financially stable. I don't want anyone looking for a nurse and a purse. And physically fit. Somebody who can still get an erection in a timely manner. Hair was optional, but teeth, she insisted, were not. Before the 80-year-old, there had been a same-age gentleman who was not so gentle. They had gone out to dinner, and the night before what was supposed to be their second date, Rita had texted him the recipe and photo of a dish he said he wanted to try. "Mmm," he texted back. "Sounds delicious." Rita was about to respond, but then another "mmm" popped up, followed by, "You're killing me here," followed by, "If you don't stop, I won't be able to stand up," followed a minute later by, "Sorry, I was texting my daughter about my bad back." "Bad back my eye, the pervert," Rita exclaimed. "He was doing who knows what with who knows who, and he certainly wasn't talking about my salmon dish." There was no second date, and no dates at all, until she met the 80-year-old. Rita had come to me at the beginning of spring. At our very first session, she was so depressed that when she gave me an account of her situation, it seemed as if she were reading an obituary. The final line had been written, and her life, she believed, was a tragedy. Thrice divorced and the mother of four troubled adults, due to her own bad mothering, she explained, grandchildless and living alone, retired from a job she disliked,
Rita saw no reason to get up in the morning. Her list of mistakes was long. Choosing the wrong husbands. Failing to put her children's needs above her own, including not protecting them from their alcoholic father. Not using her skills in a professionally fulfilling way. Not making an effort when she was younger to form a community. She had numbed herself with denial for as long as that worked. Recently, it had lost its efficacy. Even painting, the one activity she enjoyed and excelled at, barely held her interest. Now, her 70th birthday was coming up, and she had struck a deal with herself to make her life better by then or stop living it. "I think I'm beyond help," she concluded. "But I want to give it one last try, just to be certain." No pressure, I thought. While suicidal thoughts, known as suicidal ideation, are commonplace with depression, most people respond to treatment and never act on those hopeless impulses. In fact, it's as patients begin to get better that the risk for suicide increases. During this short window, they're no longer so depressed that eating or dressing seem like monumental efforts, but they're still in enough pain to want to end it all. A dangerous mix of residual distress and newfound energy. But once the depression lifts and suicidal thoughts subside, a new window opens. That's when the person can make changes that improve life significantly over the long term. Whenever suicide comes up, either because the patient or the therapist broaches the topic, bringing it up does not, as some worry, plant the idea in a person's head. The therapist has to assess the situation. Does the patient have a concrete plan? Is there a means to carry out the plan? A gun in the house, a spouse out of town? Have there been previous attempts? Are there particular risk factors? Lack of social support or being male? Men commit suicide 3 times more often than women. Often people talk about suicide not because they want to be dead, but because they want to end their pain. If they can just find a way to do that, they very much want to be alive. We make the best assessment we can, and as long as there's no imminent danger, we monitor the situation closely and work with the depression. If the person is set on suicide, though, there are a series of steps to take right away. Rita was telling me that she would kill herself, but she was very clear that she would wait out the year and not do anything before her 70th birthday. She wanted change, not death. As it was, she was already dead inside. For now, suicide wasn't my concern. What was concerning to me, though, was Rita's age. I'm ashamed to admit this, but at first I worried that I might secretly agree with Rita's grim perspective. Maybe she really was beyond help, or at least beyond the kind of help she wanted. A therapist is supposed to be a container for the hope that a depressed person can't yet hold, and I wasn't seeing much hope here. Typically, I see possibility, because the people who are depressed have something to keep them going. It might be a job that gets them out of bed, even if they don't love that particular job. A network of friends, just 1 or 2 people they can talk to. Or contact with some family members, problematic but present. Having children in the house or a beloved pet or religious faith can also protect against suicide. But most notably, the depressed people I saw were younger, more malleable. Their lives might seem bleak now, but they had time to turn things around and create something new. Rita, however, seemed like a cautionary tale. A senior citizen, utterly alone, lacking in purpose and full of regret. By her account, she had never truly been loved by anybody. The only child of older and distant parents, she had messed up her own children so badly that none of them spoke to her, and she had no friends or relatives or social life. Her father had been dead for decades, and her mother had died at 90 after suffering for years with Alzheimer's. She looked me in the eye and presented me with a challenge. "Realistically," she asked, "what could change at this late date?" About a year earlier, I'd gotten a call from a well-respected psychiatrist in his late 70s. He asked if I would see his patient, a woman in her 30s, who was considering freezing her eggs while she continued to look for a partner. He thought that this woman might benefit from consultation with me because, he said, he didn't know enough about the dating and baby-making landscape for today's 30-somethings. Now, I knew how he felt. I wasn't sure that I fully understood the aging landscape for today's senior citizens. I'd learned in my training about the unique challenges faced by older adults. And yet, this age group gets short shrift when it comes to mental health services. For some, therapy is a foreign concept, like TiVo. And besides, their generation grew up largely believing that they could get through it, whatever it was, on their own. Others, living on retirement savings and seeking help at low-cost clinics, don't feel comfortable seeing the 20-something therapy interns who predominantly staff them. Before long, these patients drop out. Still, other older people assume that what they're feeling is a normal part of aging and don't realize that treatment might help. The result is that many therapists see relatively few seniors in their practices. At the same time, old age is a proportionately larger percentage of the average person's life than it used to be. Unlike the 60-year-olds of a few generations ago, the 60-year-olds of today are often at the top of their games in terms of skill, knowledge, and experience, but they're still pushed out professionally for younger employees. The average life expectancy in the United States now hovers around 80, and it's becoming common to live into one's 90s. So what happens to these 60-year-olds' identities during the decades they still have left? With aging comes the potential to accrue many losses: health, family, friends, work, and purpose. But Rita, I realized, wasn't experiencing loss primarily as a result of aging. Instead, as she aged, she was becoming aware of the losses she had been living with her entire life. Here she was, wanting a second chance, a chance she was giving herself only a year to realize. As she saw it, she had lost so much that she had nothing left to lose. That part I agreed with too. Mostly. She could still lose her health and beauty. Tall and slim, with large green eyes and high cheekbones, her thick, naturally red hair flecked with just a few strands of gray, Rita was genetically blessed with the complexion of a 40-year-old. Terrified of living as long as her mother had and running out of retirement funds, she refused to pay for what she called modern beauty expenses, her euphemism for Botox. She also attended an exercise class at the Y every morning, just to have a reason to get out of bed. Her physician, who had sent her to me, said that she was one of the healthiest people her age I've seen. But in every other way, Rita seemed dead, lifeless. Even her movements were listless, like the way she sauntered to the sofa in slow motion, a sign of depression known as psychomotor retardation. This slowing down of coordinated efforts between the brain and the body might also explain why I kept missing the tissue box in Wendell's office. Often at the beginning of therapy, I'll ask patients to recount the past 24 hours in as much detail as possible. In this way, I get a good sense of the current situation, their level of connectedness and sense of belonging, how their lives are peopled, what their responsibilities and stressors are, how peaceful or volatile their relationships might be, and how they choose to spend their time. It turns out that most of us aren't aware of how we actually spend our time, or what we really do all day, until we break it down hour by hour and say it out loud. Here's how Rita's days went. Get up early. Menopause ruined my sleep. Drive to the Y. Come home. Eat breakfast while watching Good Morning America. Paint or nap. Eat lunch while reading the paper. Paint or nap. Heat up frozen dinner. It's too much trouble cooking for one. Sit on her building stoop. I like to look at the babies and puppies that people walk at dusk. Watch junk on TV. Fall asleep. Rita seemed to have almost no contact with other human beings. Many days she talked to nobody. But what struck me most about her life wasn't just how solitary it was, but how nearly everything she said or did conjured for me an image of death. As Andrew Solomon wrote in The Noonday Demon, the opposite of depression isn't happiness, but vitality. Vitality. Yes, Rita had had lifelong depression and a complicated history, but I wasn't sure that her past should be our initial focus. Even if she hadn't given herself a one-year deadline, there was another deadline that neither of us could change. Mortality. As with Julie, I wondered what the goal should be in treating her. Did she just need somebody to talk to ease the pain and loneliness? Or was she willing to understand her role in creating it? It was also the question I was struggling with in Wendell's office. What should be accepted and what should be changed in my own life? But I was more than 2 decades younger than Rita. Was it too late for her to redeem herself? Is it ever too late for that? And what degree of emotional discomfort would she be willing to endure to find out? I thought about how regret can go one of 2 ways. It can either shackle you to the past or serve as an engine for change. Rita said that she wanted her life to improve by her 70th birthday. Instead of dredging up the past 7 decades, I thought, maybe we should start with trying to inject her life with a little vitality. Now. Companionship? Rita says today, after I tell her that I won't try to talk her out of finding companionship with men under 75. Oh, honey, please don't be so naive. I want more than companionship. I'm not dead yet. Even I know how to order something on the internet from the privacy of my apartment. It takes me a minute to connect the dots. She buys vibrators. Good for her. Do you know, Rita adds, how long it's been since I've been touched? Rita goes on to describe how disheartening she finds the dating scene. And in this regard, at least, she's not alone. It's the most common refrain I hear from single women of all ages. Dating sucks. Marriage, though, hasn't been much better for her. She'd met the man who would be husband number one when she was 20 years old, eager to escape her dreary home. She commuted to college each day and went from dying of boredom and silence to a world of interesting ideas and people. But she also had to hold down a job. And while she sat in a real estate agent's office typing up mind-numbing correspondence after class, she missed out on the social life she craved. Enter Richard, a charming, sophisticated upperclassman in her English seminar, with whom she had deep conversations and who swept her off her feet and into the life she wanted. Until their first child was born a couple of years later. That's when Richard started working longer hours and drinking. Soon, Rita was just as bored and lonely as she had been in her childhood home. After 4 kids, countless fights, and too many drunken episodes during which Richard struck both her and their children, Rita wanted out. But how? What could she do? She had dropped out of college. How would she support herself and the kids? With Richard, the kids had clothes and food and good schools and friends. What could she, by herself, offer them? In many ways, Rita felt like a child herself, helpless. Soon Richard wasn't the only one who drank. It wasn't until a particularly terrifying incident that Rita screwed up the courage to leave. But by then, her children were well into their teens, and the family was a shambles. She married husband number 2 5 years later. Edward was Richard's opposite, a kind and caring widower who'd recently lost his wife. After her divorce at age 39, Rita had returned to tedious secretarial work, her only marketable skill, despite her keen intelligence and artistic talent. Edward was a client of the insurance agent Rita worked for. They married 6 months after they met. But Edward was still grieving his wife's death, and Rita felt envious of his love for her. They argued constantly. The marriage lasted 2 years, and then Edward called it quits. Husband number 3 left his wife for Rita, and 5 years later, he left Rita for someone else. Each time, Rita was shocked to find herself alone. But her history didn't surprise me. We marry our unfinished business. For the next decade, Rita steered clear of dating. Not that she met men anyway, holed up in her apartment or aerobicizing at the Y. Then came the recent reality of an 80-year-old's body. So withered and saggy compared to the body of her last husband, who had been only 55 at the time of their divorce. Rita had met Mr. Saggy, as she called him, through the dating app. And because I wanted to be touched, she said, I thought I could give it a try. He had looked young for his age, she explained, more like 70, and handsome, in clothing, that is. After they had sex, she told me he had wanted to cuddle, but she'd escaped to the bathroom, where she discovered an entire pharmacy of medications, including Viagra. Finding the whole scene revolting, Rita found many things revolting.
She waited until her date was fast asleep. His snores sounded as revolting as his orgasm, and took a taxi home. Never again, she says now. I try to imagine sleeping with an 80-year-old, and wonder if most elderly people are put off by their partner's bodies. Is it jarring only to those who haven't been with an older body before? Do people who have been together 50 years not notice because they acclimate to the gradual changes over time? I remember reading a news story in which a couple, married for more than 60 years, was asked for tips on happy marriages. After the usual advice about communication and compromise, the husband added that oral sex was still in their repertoire. Naturally, this story spread like wildfire online, and most of the commenters were disgusted. Given the public's visceral reactions to aging bodies, it's no wonder old people don't get touched much. But it's a deep human need. It's well documented that touch is important for well-being throughout our lifetimes. Touch can lower blood pressure and stress levels, boost moods and immune systems. Babies can die from lack of touch, and so can adults. Adults who are touched regularly live longer. There's even a term for this condition, skin hunger. Rita tells me that she splurges on pedicures, not because it matters if her toenails are painted. Who's going to see them? But because the only human touch she gets is from a woman named Connie. Connie has been doing her toes for years and doesn't speak a lick of English. But her foot massages, Rita says, are heaven. When she got divorced for the third time, Rita didn't know how to live without being touched even for a week. She'd get antsy, she says. Then it was a month. Then years turned to a decade. She doesn't like to spend the money on a pedicure nobody will see. But what choice does she have? The pedicures are a necessity, because she'll go crazy with no human contact at all. It's like going to a prostitute, paying to be touched, Rita says. Like John does with me, I think. I'm his emotional hooker. The point, Rita is saying about the 80-year-old, is that I thought it would feel good to be touched by a man again. But I think I'll just stick with my pedicures. I tell her that the choices aren't necessarily limited to either Connie or an 80-year-old, but Rita shoots me a look and I know what she's thinking. I don't know who you'll meet, I concede. But maybe you'll be touched, both physically and emotionally, by somebody you care about and who cares about you. Maybe you'll be touched in an entirely new way, one that's more satisfying than your other relationships have been. I'm expecting a click of the tongue, which I've come to recognize as Rita's version of an eye roll. But she goes quiet, her green eyes filling with tears. Let me tell you a story, she says, fishing out a crumpled, used-looking tissue from the depths of her purse, even though a fresh box sits right beside her on the end table. There's a family in the apartment across from mine, she begins. Moved in about a year ago. New to town, saving up for a house. Two small children. The husband works from home and plays with the kids in the courtyard, hoisting them onto his shoulders and giving them piggyback rides and tossing a ball with them. All the things I never had. She reaches into her purse for more tissues. Can't find any, and dabs her eyes with the one she's just blown her nose into. I always wonder why she doesn't take a clean tissue from the box a few inches from her. Anyway, she says, every day around 5 p.m., the mother comes home from work, and every day the same thing happens. Rita chokes up here, stops. More nose blowing and eye dabbing. Take the damn tissues, I want to scream. This pained woman, whom nobody talks to or touches, won't even let herself have a clean tissue. Rita squeezes what's left of the snot ball in her hand, wipes her eyes, and takes a breath. Every day, she continues, the mother unlocks the front door, opens it up, and calls out, Hello, family. That's how she greets them. Hello, family. Her voice falters, and she takes a minute to compose herself. The children, Rita explains, come running, squealing with joy, and her husband gives her a big, excited kiss. Rita tells me that she watches all this through the peephole that she secretly had enlarged for spying purposes. Don't judge, she says. And do you know what I do? She asks. I know it's horribly ungenerous, but I seethe with anger. She's sobbing now. There's never been a hello family for me.
I try to imagine the kind of family Rita might fashion for herself at this point in her life. Perhaps with a partner, or a rapprochement with her adult children. But I wonder about other possibilities, too. What she might do with her passion for art, or how she might form some new friendships. I think about the abandonment she experienced as a child, and the trauma her own children experienced. How all of them must feel so ripped off and full of resentment that none of them can see what's actually there and what kind of lives they might still be able to create. And how, for a while, I haven't been able to see it for Rita either. I walk over to the tissue box, hand it to Rita, then sit down next to her on the couch. "Thank you," she says. "Where did those come from?" "They've been there all along," I say. But instead of taking a fresh tissue, she continues to wipe her face with the snot ball. In the car on the way home, I call Jen. I know she's probably also in the car driving home. When she picks up, I say, "Please, tell me that I won't still be dating in retirement." She laughs. "I don't know. I might be dating in retirement. People used to hang it up once their spouses died. Now they date." I hear the blare of horns before she continues. "And there are so many divorced people out there, too. Are you trying to tell me you're having marital problems?" "Yes." "He's farting again?" "Yes." It's their ongoing joke. Jen has warned her husband that she's moving into the next room at night if he keeps eating dairy. But he loves dairy and she loves him, so she never moves. I pull into the driveway and tell Jen I have to go. I park the car and unlock the front door to our house, where my son is being cared for by his babysitter, Caesar. Technically, Caesar works for us, but really he's like an older brother to my son and a second son to me. We're close with his parents and sibling and his multitude of cousins, and I've watched him grow up through the years into the college student he is now, taking care of my son as he grows too. I open the door and yell, "Hello, family!" Zach shouts from his room, "Hey, Mom!" Caesar takes off an earbud and calls out from the kitchen where he's preparing dinner, "Hey!" Nobody runs up excitedly to greet me. Nobody squeals with delight. But I don't feel deprived the way Rita does. Just the opposite. I go to my bedroom to change into sweatpants, and when I come back out, we all start talking at once, sharing our days, teasing one another, vying for airtime, putting plates on the table and pouring the drinks. The boys bicker over setting the table and race to get the bigger portions. Hello, family. I once told Wendell that I'm a terrible decision maker, that often what I think I want doesn't turn out the way I'd imagined. But there were two notable exceptions, and both proved to be the best decisions of my life. In each case, I was nearly 40. One was my decision to have a baby. The other was my decision to become a therapist. Chapter 25. The UPS Guy. The year Zach was born, I began acting inappropriately with my UPS delivery guy. I don't mean that I tried to seduce him. It's hard to be seductive with milk stains on your t-shirt. I mean that whenever he delivered a package, which was often given the need for baby supplies, I would try to detain him with conversation simply because I craved adult company. I'd strain to make small talk about the weather, a news headline, even the weight of a package. "Wow, who knew diapers were so heavy? Do you have kids?" While the UPS driver fake smiled and nodded as he not so subtly backed away from me to the safety of his truck. At the time, I was working from home as a writer, which meant that all day, I sat alone in my pajamas at a computer when I wasn't feeding, changing, bouncing, or otherwise engaging with an adorable but demanding 10-pound human with a talent for screaming like a banshee. Basically, I interacted with what I called, in my darkest moments, a gastrointestinal tract with lungs. Before having a baby, I'd relished the freedom of a non-office job. But now I longed to get dressed every day and be in the company of verbal grown-ups. It was during this perfect storm of isolation and plummeting estrogen that I started to wonder if I'd made a mistake by leaving medical school. Journalism suited me well. I got to cover hundreds of topics for dozens of publications, and they all revolved around a common thread that fascinated me: the human psyche. I didn't want to stop writing. But now, while reeking of spit up in the middle of the night,
I reconsidered the possibility of a dual career. If I became a psychiatrist, I reasoned, I could interact with people in a meaningful way, helping them to be happier. But I could also have the flexibility to write and spend time with my family. I sat on the idea for a few weeks, until one spring morning, I called up my former dean at Stanford and floated my plan by her. A renowned researcher, she was also the med school version of a camp mom. Warm, wise, intuitive. I had run her mother-daughter book group when I was in medical school and knew her well. I was sure that after I explained my thought process, she would be supportive of my plan. Instead, she said, "Why would you do that?" And then, "Besides, psychiatrists don't make people happy." I remembered the old medical school quip. Psychiatrists don't make people happy. Prescriptions do. Suddenly sobered. I knew what she meant. It wasn't that she didn't respect psychiatrists. It was that psychiatry today tends to be more about the nuances of medication and neurotransmitters than the subtleties of people's life stories. All of which she knew I knew. Anyway, she asked, did I really want to do 3 years of residency with a toddler? Did I want to spend time with my son before he started kindergarten? Did I remember talking with her as a medical student about my desire to have more substantial relationships with patients than the contemporary medical model afforded? Then, just as I imagined my former dean shaking her head on the other end of the phone, just when I wished I could turn back time so that this conversation had never happened, she said something that would change the course of my life. You should go to graduate school and get a degree in clinical psychology. By going the clinical psychology route, she said, I could work with people in the way I'd always talked about. The appointments would be 50 minutes instead of 15, and the work would be deeper and longer term. I got chills. People often use that expression loosely, but I actually did get chills, goosebumps and all. It was shocking how right this felt, as if my life's plan had finally been revealed. In journalism, I thought, I could tell people stories, but I wasn't changing their stories. As a therapist, I could help people change their stories. And with this dual career, I could have the perfect combination. Being a therapist is going to require a blend of the cognitive and the creative, the dean continued. There's an artistry in combining the two. What could be a better mix of your abilities and interests? Not long after that conversation, I sat in a room with college seniors and took the GRE, the graduate school version of the SAT. I applied to a local graduate program, and over the next few years, I worked toward my degree. And I continued to write, hearing stories and sharing them, while learning to help people change as my life changed too. During this time, my son began to talk and walk, and the UPS guy's deliveries gradually evolved from diapers to Legos. Oh, the Jedi Starfighter, I'd say. Are you a Star Wars fan? And when I was finally ready to graduate, I told the UPS guy the news. For the first time, he didn't try to run for his truck. Instead, he leaned over and hugged me. Congratulations, he said, his arms wrapped around my back. Wow, you did all that already? And with a kid, too. I'm proud of you. I stood there, shocked and moved, embracing my UPS guy. When we finally let go, he told me that he had news too. He wouldn't be on my route anymore. Like me, he'd decided to go back to school. And to save on rent, he needed to move in with his family, who lived a few hours away. He wanted to become a contractor. Congratulations to you, I said, throwing my arms around him. I'm proud of you too. We probably looked odd. That must have been some package, I imagined the neighbors murmuring. But we stayed that way for what felt like a long time, delighted by how far we'd both come. I'm Sam, by the way, he said, after we finished hugging. I'm Lori, by the way, I said. He'd always called me ma'am before. I know. He gestured with his chin to the package with my name on the address label. We both laughed. Well, Sam, I'll be rooting for you, I said. Thanks, he replied. I'll need it. I shook my head. I have a feeling you'll do just fine, but I'll root for you anyway. Then Sam asked for my signature one last time and left, giving me a thumbs up from the driver's seat as he pulled away in his big brown truck. A couple of years later, I received a business card from Sam.
I saved your address, he wrote on a post-it attached to the card. If you have any friends who need my services, I would appreciate the business. I was midway through my internship, and I placed his card in my drawer for later, knowing exactly when I'd use it. The bookshelves in my office? Built by Sam. Chapter 26. Embarrassing Public Encounters. Early in our relationship, boyfriend and I were standing in line at the frozen yogurt place when one of my therapy patients walked in. Wow, hi, Keisha said, taking her place in line behind us. It's so funny running into you here. She turned to her right. This is Luke. Luke, who was 30-ish and attractive like Keisha, smiled and shook my hand. Although we'd never met, I knew exactly who he was. I knew that Luke was the boyfriend who had recently cheated on Keisha, and that she'd figure this out because he'd been unable to get an erection with her. Each time he cheated, the same thing happened. His guilt, she once said, is in his penis. I also knew that Keisha was preparing to leave him. She'd come to understand what had drawn her to him in the first place, and wanted to be more intentional about choosing a trustworthy partner. In our last session, she had said that she planned to break up with him this weekend. It was now Saturday. Had she decided to stay with him, I wondered? Or was she going to break it off on Sunday so that she'd have the structure of Monday's workday to help her stay the course? She'd told me that she wanted to tell Luke in a public place so that he wouldn't make a scene and beg her to stay, which he'd done when she attempted the conversation at her apartment twice before. She didn't want to cave again just because he said all the right things to convince her to change her mind. In the yogurt line, boyfriend was standing next to me expectantly, waiting to be introduced.